I went to Reynaldo Sanchez in Modern Languages and said, I don't know, what do you think, but I think we should finish this because, you know, otherwise we're going to be here forever, you see? It's unbelievable. It's so, such a big thing.
Let me try to get a record level. I'm just going to...
Let's see. Are these your questions?
No. No. Let me prop this on my pocketbook here. Just leave it, and I think that will be best.
Okay. How were you the last time? I mean,
we propped it up on different things. I don't have a microphone stand, unfortunately, which makes it difficult. But I think that will come out good. I have these questions. Now, first of all, tell me about your family. You told me that you were not always in Miami. So where were your parents from?
Well, my father is from Spain, from the north of Spain, and my mother is from Cuba. And, you know, I left Cuba with my husband and my daughter on June the 2nd, 1962. The very same day that my sister also left Cuba with her family, her husband and her two children. And then my sister went to Atlanta because my brother-in-law studied at Georgia Tech. And I remained in Miami, but a month and a half later, I joined them in Atlanta. And then, you know, since that day, I lived in Atlanta until November 1977. You know, that day I moved to Miami. Mm-hmm. Then 16 years there.
Mm-hmm. Why did you leave?
Cuba. Because I didn't agree with the political system that we had in Cuba. You know, actually, it's an interesting thing to think now, you know, in perspective. When I heard Castro, I think, if I'm not mistaken, his first speech was done January the 9th, 1959. And then, you know, I was across the street from my parents, and I was married already, but I was living with them, waiting for my house to, waiting to move to my new house. And then it was interesting, because when I heard his speech, you know, in Cuba, we always talk about Americans. We never mention the word gringo. And, you know, that calls very much my attention, you know, when he actually make a joke mentioning the word gringo. And that was something, you know, that somehow bothered me because, you know, in Cuba, actually, we discriminate, like in every country. But, I mean, it was not kind of aggressive discrimination in the way of calling foreigners with, you know, names or things like that. You see, another thing that called very much my attention was that he said that he was dreaming of Los Andes as the Sierra Maestra of America. And of course that, you know, somehow turned alive on my mind because, you know, I thought, my goodness, the Sierra Maestra of America, it means that he's planning to extend his revolution, you see. And somehow I got a feeling, perhaps intuition, I cannot say, you know, that I was fully aware of his intention, but I don't know immediately that he said that. You know, I just said to my friend, this is horrible. We just, you know, I got rid of Batista, and now we have a communist here. And, you know, they didn't believe, you know, they couldn't believe that I said such a thing. Just a few, you know, it was January, actually, the 31st, when Batista flew Cuba, and then I was just saying such a statement January the 9th, just 8 days later. And then my friends, these friends with whom I was talking, are living now in Valencia, Venezuela. And, you know, after, you know, the whole thing was over and we were in exile, they confessed to me that day they said when they went home, my goodness, what an incredible people. Because, you know, first they didn't agree with Batista, now they are against Fidel, just right away. But, you know, that was a kind of feeling. You see, somehow I detected, you see. Another thing that called very much my attention was the way in which they conducted, you see, the trials against the people, you know, that were with Batista. Because it's not that they were not criminals. I don't, you know, I realized that a lot of injustice was done in Cuba and a lot of criminal acts. But that was actually like a circus, you see. They were actually creating a big political atmosphere. And, you know, so many abuses that I knew, you know, of little people and things that perhaps were not noticed as a whole in the country. But special cases like people who didn't do anything, you see, because we knew them and they were until the last minute in the city doing absolutely nothing. And suddenly, you know, they became big leaders of the revolution. And they were well-known communists, you see, before Castro. Then these things actually were details to take into account for somebody who likes to examine reality. then, you know, these things, you know, hit my mind, you see, and I start putting things together, and I realized immediately that we were in front of a communist system, and so many different things that I knew. For example, I had a brother-in-law who was a classmate of the minister of the Ministro de Defensa, perhaps how you call it, army minister, secretary of the army, something like that at the time. I don't know how to translate it into English, you know, the equivalence. That you see, they were classmates in Havana University, and they loved us brothers, you know, for so many years. And actually, when he came to Havana, he asked my brother-in-law to go to these, you know, the government offices to work with him in the construction of the new country, like they call it, and all that. And then when my brother-in-law started examining the new laws that they were planning and all that, and he also had the opportunity to be in contact with the attorney general of the country at the moment. Serguera, his name, last name, I don't know if he's still alive, if he's still with the government or what, but I mean, you know, he was at the moment in charge of that position. And then, you know, when they start discussing in kind of closed environment what the revolution was planning, my brother-in-law mentioned, you know, they make a big propaganda saying that Batista killed 20,000 Cubans. And then my brother-in-law said, if Batista killed, you know, 20,000 Cubans, this is going to cost much more. Then answer of that man, who cares if our ideas are consolidated, will be consolidated, you see? That's such a horrible statement, you know. And of course, they didn't say that in public, but, you know, we had this opportunity to hear these things firsthand, you see, because this was said to my brother-in-law. And then, you know, I knew, you see, that we have to leave. I knew that, you know, that was not a political system for me. I love freedom. You know, I respect very much the rights of others, the same way I like to be, you know, my rights be respected. Then, how could I live in a country like that? I also had a daughter, and I didn't want my daughter, you know, to grow up in an environment of such horror and, you know, destruction, because I saw that. Before I left Cuba, I had the opportunity to see all this, and, you know, also seeing the indoctrination going on all the time. And, you know, for me, it's very important that a human being has an opportunity to judge reality on his own. And whether he's right or wrong, you know, actually exercise the privilege of expressing whatever his opinion is, as long as this opinion do not offend, you know, the public, you see. It's just something that you're entitled as a human being. I think this is a right that everybody has, and nobody can, you know, destroy that in a human being.
Right.
Or you know, impede that something like this can be exercised.
When Batista was in, what were things like in Cuba? I know it wasn't perfect, it wasn't good, but what was it, very bad, or do you think that maybe people? I'm trying to understand how Castro could have caught the imagination of the people.
Yeah,
I guess he promised a better world.
No, what happened is, you see, during Batista's time, actually, economically, Cuba was at his best. On her best, if you want to call Cuba girl. Like, Cuba was at her best. Actually, we never had a better economic situation in the island. But you see, the thing is that Batista was, like, you might say, the last drop in a cup, to fill a cup. You see, actually, this is a long process that began many, many years back. Actually, we can go back to the beginning of the Republic, you see. Actually, in my opinion, we never had a chance to consolidate as a nation, because we began, you see, actually we were the country in Latin America that have to struggle longer for our freedom. You see, actually we had three wars. We have the 10-year, you know, war, we have what we call the small war that lasts 1 year, and then we have the independent war that lasts 4 years. Then altogether, imagine how many years Cubans were fighting for freedom. And besides, in between these periods of war, we had so many, you know, people actually working on conspiracies and things like that, in which, you know, so many Cubans actually lost their life. Then, you know, it's a long, long process. Then when the war was about to be ended, because Spain couldn't hold any longer, you see, their possessions in America, especially Cuba. And now the archives are open. We can check this, you know, verify these facts. Spain couldn't, except that, you know, for special reasons, like, for example, the minister of the of what you might call of the foreign minister in Spain had a wife who was a Cuban, and she has a lot of property in Havana. And because of private reasons, they didn't want to lose Cuba. You see, they want to hold Cuba until the last minute to be able to actually maintain, you know, the money they have in Cuba. And not only his case, his name is Ilvela, the minister I'm talking about, but so many others, important men in the government were in the same situation. They had so many interests in Cuba, economic interests, and they didn't want to lose the island. Then, of course, that, you know, somehow allowed Spain to see the intervention of the United States as something good for them. Then they actually, the Treaty of Paris was done between Spain and USA, and Cuba have nothing to do, Cubans, when Cubans actually deserve more than anybody else to do that on their own. Actually, no treaty should be done because, you know, Cubans actually have the right to be free. And then because of that treaty, you see the economic life of Cuba didn't change at all. The money stayed in the hands of the Spaniards. Native only had what they used to have before. Actually, they were the owners of some land that was what, you know, the Spanish colonial government allowed to, you know, to native own, to own. And, you know, the situation, Cuba was very impoverished. You see, with so many years of war, they didn't have anything. You see, the fields were destroyed because I don't know if you know this this fact, but actually Cuba have, or Spain have, the horrible honor of creating the first concentration camp. You see, it was done in Cuba with Valeriano Weyler. You see, the Spanish general, he concentrated the population in the cities, and Cubans died by tons, you see, by thousands, because of the, you know, epidemics and because of lack of, you know, sources of nourishment. In no way, you see, people were not cultivating the fields, and the whole island was destroyed. That was the actually type of tactic that Spain used to overcome the impetus and actually the victory of the Cuban native. No way, Spain couldn't hold any longer. You see, that colony, we were decided at the or actually my ancestors were decided to become free. And Spain couldn't do anything. Then when USA intervened, you see, you know, of the Enmienda Platt, the Platt Amendment, which actually was an appended addict to the Constitution of Cuba, in which USA have the right to intervene in the, or actually to mingle in the internal affairs of Cuba. And this, of course, was something that Cuban resent a lot. And then, you know, there was so much contact between the Cuban governments and USA, and actually Cubans never were able to acquire political maturity. You see, it was something that we actually were like little babies. We always had a babysitter, you see, taking care of us politically. Then, you know, Batista appeared in the political arena in the 30s, you see, a little bit before, actually. You know, he began in a kind of quiet way with Machado, the dictator, the first dictator we had. And then, you know, he took over and actually dominated the political scene in Cuba since that period, Machado period, up to, you know, the beginning of the revolution. Then he was actually a kind of black shade. Sometimes he didn't appear in public, but he was there, you see, controlling the situation. Then in between, we have certain other governments that were legally elected, but I mean, you know, Batista was always the gloomy, you know, shade behind things, you know, controlling. And then, you know, the revolution actually was something created by Fidel. You see, this kind of environment, because as I mentioned before, you know, the economic situation in Cuba was excellent at the time of Batista, except that Batista, you know, was illegally in the government. He was a dictator, and nobody likes to have a dictator, you see. Everybody wants to have a you know, real, genuine government that actually expresses the opinion of the majority and preserves the rights of the minorities. And we didn't have that. But Fidel, or Castro, actually was a very smart man. He was able to maneuver, you know, so many little things that create this big atmosphere in Cuba. Actually, it's interesting because he copied, in order to organize, you see, the revolution abroad, he copied exactly the plans of Martí. he went town by town in USA doing the same, and you know, and actually in different places, Mexico, he establishes like what was called at the time of Martí revolutionary clubs, you see, to support Cuba, and then he did the same. And he he did what was necessary to create conflicts. He, for example, placed bombs and in places, then or order people to do that, and then you know, of course, next day you know what to expect from the government. He was killing students and creating this kind of thing. Then Batista was horrible, and you know, I couldn't agree with somebody like him, but I mean. They took actually action against the people who directly were against them. This is more or less the situation. If you more or less live your life quietly, they didn't bother you.
Right.
Except that of course they have to bother anybody who thinks, because you know if you see abuse committed on others, you know that it's a matter of time for that to come to you. And actually nobody who is humanitarian or is intelligent can approve of such type of behavior. Actually nobody who was somebody Cuban or actually loved the country wanted to have a dictator. But we wanted a change, and we were very tired, you see, of corruption in the government and all these sort of things in the nation. But we didn't want a communist system. We want something free. Actually, actually Martí was very worried about the destiny of the Americas, when he talks about Americas, he talks about Latin American countries, Spanish-speaking countries. He was very worried about the future of us having such a big country next to us. He didn't want, for example, USA to rule the life of the Latin American countries, and even less, he never spoke about it, because at the time, of course, Russia didn't exist as a political power, but I mean, I'm sure he won't approve of Russia mingling with us. After all, we have nothing in common with Russians. You see, except that we are humans. That's the only thing. And sometimes I doubt it. If they are that. But that's the only thing in common we have, because it's nothing. You see,
right. It's very hard, I think, for a small country to have self-determination with the big powers that do have always played a big brother kind of role, where they go in and kind of say, we know what's best, and, do it this way, which happens not only in Cuba, but in all the countries now. There's a lot of trying to be self-sustaining. But it seems like in the case of Cuba, as we say, you went out of the frying pan into the fire.
Of course.
from one bad, bad system to another. And I'm curious, you said your father's Spanish and your mom's Cuban. Mm-hmm. How did they meet?
Cuba.
In Cuba?
My father went to Cuba.
And they meet in Cuba. Was he a businessman?
No, my father worked for an American company in Cuba. He worked for the, power company, you see, in Cuba.
Well, did they get out of Cuba too, or were they still living at the time?
Yes, you mean...
When Castro came in.
Oh, sure. They actually took 7 years to be able to get them over here, you see, to bring them over here. It was absolutely horrible, because, it's... we left actually in June the 2nd, 62, and in October was the missile crisis, and then the flights were closed, they couldn't come, you see, and then we start struggling and see how we could obtain visas to allow them to leave the country through other avenues, and it was very, very hard. 7 years actually took the whole process to be able to, bring them over the United States.
Well, how did you get out so early? Did you just knew?
I could leave before, except that, my husband was determined to fight, against Castro, and he was very involved in the counter-revolutionary, movement. And then, I had at the time, my daughter at the time was very small. Then, of course, he told me, just leave Cuba, with the girl, and you save her and save yourself. Then I said, no, you're wrong. We are a family. Then if you decide to stay, I'll stay here. And if we go the three of us together. And then, finally, he was in prison 3 times. And then finally, he was released, and I came with a fraudulent visa. It was a beautiful one, by the way. A counter-revolutionary, you know, organization actually stamped that in our passport. It was absolutely beautiful, except for the signature of the council that was not like the good one, because my sister had a good one. And then, you know, we compared both passports, and mine, the signature was a little bit different, but it was absolutely beautiful. Even the seal was stamped and everything. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And then when I came, you know, the offices in immigration had three lines, one for women, one for men, and a third line for people who have, you know, problems. They said, don't be scared. You are not going to be deported under no circumstances. Then, you know, just go to the third line if you have any problems. Then there were only three people in the line, one man, my husband, and myself. Then, you know, I surrendered my passports, which were returned to me later on, years later, of course with a big sign that I voided. But, you know, it was interesting because that allowed us to escape from Cuba. But yeah, you won't believe it, I didn't have that. I had the telegram. They sent a cable to every Cuban at the time that I, you know, left Cuba. They sent a cable authorizing your departure from Cuba. And actually, I didn't have my passport with me 3 days before the trip was actually scheduled. And I was scared to death, you know, that what could happen to my passport. Finally, you know, the underground organization, you know, had it ready and sent it to us, and we left. Then, you know, imagine in the airport when that man was checking, you know, the immigration officer in Cuba was checking the papers. You know, I was very scared, but of course I have to be, you know, I imagine that if they could give Oscars to people, as you know, that day I could win one, because I pretend that nothing was going on when I was actually checking inside of myself. But I knew that that was, you know, my freedom and my husband and daughter freedom, and we couldn't, you know, show any feelings. Actually, right, you know, we just behaved casually, showed the papers and gathered all the papers back when they finished, you know, checking, and went to board the plane. And it was absolutely incredible. When we saw ourselves, you know, going up on the air, we couldn't believe it. After such a nightmare. Not only that, so many other details, you see. There are so many horrible experiences in our life when we were in Cuba, you see.
Mm-hmm. Very horrible.
Horrible.
But to finally be out and to know that, you know, now you were up, going up, and
that was great. It was a big relief, you know, to know that freedom was there.
What did your husband do? In
Cuba?
Yeah.
Oh, my husband, you know, his family owned sugar plantations, and then, you know, sometimes he worked with his father, but he was working how you call it, publicitaria? It's a public relation, it's a company that does ads and things like
advertising.
Advertising agency, that's right. You know, that now, you know, they had this here in the exile, not his family, I mean, you know, the people who own that, because a sister-in-law of him was, let's see, the owner's aunt, you know, it was,
right,
we are not related, but I mean, you know, somehow we're in the family. And then, you know, they now have this company here in so many countries in Latin America, and they are recently opened one office here in Miami.
When you came to Miami, then, were there very many Cuban people living here at that time?
I only stayed here for a month and a half.
Just
and
a month.
There
to
were,
get
you know,
to
Atlanta, but there were some Cubans here,
mm-hmm,
you know.
What about in Atlanta? There probably weren't.
No, in Atlanta there were not, you know, so many Cubans. Some Latins, but I mean, not a big amount of Cubans. Actually, you know, the group was very small.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Was it hard to adjust?
A little bit.
Yeah.
He said it wasn't easy, but, you know, we moved in a neighborhood that we were the only ones, you know, the only Cubans, and we lived for a long time, you know, in that type of situation, very isolated, you see, of any other, you know, Spanish-speaking people, but we managed, you see,
uh-huh,
we learned English.
Yeah. Did you notice any people discriminating in Atlanta?
No, people were extremely kind to me.
That's good.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, especially during the missile crisis and all, while you were they were just really...
No, our neighbors were extremely supportive and very, very nice. Actually, you know, I remember the New Year Eve, you know, which is a traditional celebration in Cuba. That year, actually, our first year in this country, we were very sad because, you know, for the first time, our family was there. We were here, and we actually didn't have any hopes in the near future, you know, to see the family or anything like that. And then we decided not to not to celebrate like usually. Then very early we went to bed and all that, and then around a quarter till 12, somebody knocked at the door, and was a neighbor downstairs. He said he was German, but you know, he remembered that he went to Cuba one, you know, New Year Eve, and he knew how Cubans celebrate. And then he came with the traditional, you know, 12 grapes of happiness that we use, and with champagne and all that. And actually, we had a very good, you know, New Year's Eve, because everybody was in pajamas in the kitchen saying Happy New Year to each other and kissing each other. And it was actually very, very sweet of him and his wife, you know, to do that for us. His wife is, you know, is American. And we really had a, you know, a wonderful time with them. It was a very odd celebration in the kitchen, yeah. But anyway, it was nice. Uh-huh. Oh, I had so many interesting memories, you know.
What are the 12 grapes of happiness?
At midnight, you see, since it's 12, we have 12 grapes, and then we eat 12 grapes, symbolizing happiness, you see. Yeah.
Terrific. Mm-hmm. So they brought those over?
Yes. For everybody, they count each of us and brought, you know, the 12 grapes for each, for each of us, including the children, and then also champagne. And, you know, we just celebrate in the kitchen. But because, you know, we didn't even have time to go to the dining room. It was almost 12. It was very sweet of them.
Yeah.
You know, like that, I have so many anecdotes, you see, of wonderful things that people did to me.
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, this ring that I have on, you see, you know, Castro prohibited, actually the government prohibited, you know, taking any euro out of Cuba. And of course, you know, I didn't bring anything. And then my brother-in-law bought a, you know, ring for my sister. And then evidently it bothers my daughter, you know, that I didn't have any ring. Then she came one vacation with my sister here to Florida, and she was talking to a lady and explaining, you know, that everybody in the family has a ring. She was at the time something like 6 years old. And then she said, you know, everybody in the family has a ring except my poor mother. Then the lady said, what happened? Then she said, oh, my aunt has a ring because my brother-in-law is rich. You know, of course it was not true, but in her mind, you know, he was able to buy a ring. Then she said, my father brought his because he didn't have, you know, it was an expensive kind because men's rings are cheaper than women. She knew the whole thing, you know, from Cuba. And then she said, my mother didn't have any. And then the lady said, what happened? Then she said, no, my father is very poor. He can buy a ring. Then this lady gave this ring to my daughter, you know, for me. And then my sister, of course, when she took this home, you know, actually she went back to the lady and asked, you know, about the ring and what happened. And then the lady told her the truth. She said, yes, I gave it to her. Then, you know, since that day, I'm engaged to Mrs. Brown.
I think that's sweet, though.
You see, it's very symbolic.
So you couldn't take any gold out of the country?
No, nothing. You only, at the time, you know, I left Cuba, you were only allowed to take something that, a combination of a ring and a watch that both together cost $45, not exceed $45. Then, you know, what can be sold? Maybe a Timex. You see, that's the only thing. Then, you know, I didn't bring anything.
Yeah. Oh, right.
No, I only came with 5 dresses.
Oh, my goodness.
That's all.
So you had to start all over again.
And 3 underwears and 2 pair of shoes. That's all.
Yeah. And that's really...
That's all.
Oh. Well,
the same for my daughter. And then for men's were only 3 suits.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, actually it was interesting because they said you have to pick in between, select between house coat or a pajama. You cannot have both. Or a gown. I decided to, you know, get a pajama. I said, my goodness, if I have to sleep in the living room, at least I'll be covered, you see?
Yeah.
And that's what I brought. Then, you know, it was horrible, really.
Yeah, so when you came over, though, did you have anybody that you could live with or get started with?
No, actually, a brother-in-law of mine was here 1 month before us. And then, you know, he said, are you planning to go? I said, no, I have no place to go. Then he said, oh, you just come with me. I just rent a house. But, you know, that house was rented for 4 people. And then, of course, we have to sneak in.
Oh,
and then any time, you know, the landlady came, we have to, you know, pretend that we were visiting, you know. It was funny. Then we stayed that way for a month and a half until we went to Atlanta.
Oh, that's good. Well, then you were set up.
No, it took a long time to set up because, you know, no Cubans around or no Latins.
Yeah.
You see, Atlanta... It's not a cosmopolitan place, you see. It's just a big city, but I mean, it's not cosmopolitan. They were not accustomed to foreigners. Then they offered, for example, a church, a Catholic church, offered to support all for 3 months. And then I said, you know, I actually appreciate very much what you're doing, but we are young, we are healthy, we want to work. You see, we don't want any sort of help that actually we don't deserve. You know, we want to work. But of course, they were very scared, thinking that we didn't know how to speak English, we couldn't do anything. And then it was horrible. I said, but, you know, through a translator, I said, but anything somebody else do, I look and I do the same. You see, I don't have to know how to speak to be able to do things. But they were not able to help. You know, they were very actually disoriented as far as foreigners is concerned. You know, we were like strange people coming, not having, actually they didn't have an idea what to do with, you know, foreigners.
Right. What did you miss most when you came over, though? Were there certain customs? I know you said you missed the New Year's Eve. That would have mm-hmm. been something that, you know, Americans, when they go abroad, we have Thanksgiving, and, mm-hmm. and no other country has mm-hmm. that, so you feel kind of sad because you think of that. Was there anything else that you really
actually
missed?
You know, it's New Year Eve, of course, you know, it was the first year separated, you see, and all that. But, you know, actually, when you leave a country as a political refugee, you see, it's a very difficult situation because missing becomes part of your, you know, your reality. You see,
right.
It's just your whole life. Mm-hmm. You keep missing all the time. Everything, you know, reminds you of your past. Actually, you have nothing to stand on. You have to acquire a new identity because nobody knows you. You see, you don't even know how to express yourself in the other language, at least in my case that I didn't know English. And then, you know, you don't have any common grounds to begin. You know, it's very complicated. And actually, of course, your mind constantly is going back to, you know, your native country and your family and your memories and everything, you know, that means your whole life. It's like beginning, you know,
right.
a new life, not having anything, you know, any knowledge of what is around, you see? That's exactly.
Well, why did you come back to Miami? Well, how did that happen?
No, because my husband is planning now, you know, import-export business, and this is a good place to come, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know, you see, it's strange because I was very accustomed to Atlanta, you know, my daughter grew up in Atlanta, and, you know, I have what you might call, if you want to be very kind, a southern fish, you know, Cuban southern fish, or perhaps a Georgia cracker, whatever
Georgia
you want to call it. You see,
she
actually, you know, is very southern because, you know, she grew up there and all her friends are there, and, you know, we really had, you know, so many good memories about Atlanta. But, you know, actually, I would miss a lot, you see, in there.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's even though the environment is very similar to my father's native land, it's very, very similar to the north of Spain.
Uh-huh.
You see, the cities, it rains a lot, and, you know, it's very green, like Galicia and all that. But, you know, in spite of all these things that are dear to me, you see, I miss Cuba a lot.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, somehow in here, you know, I feel a lot better, you see.
Well, when you came to Miami, was
at the beginning, was not that way, you see. I felt very, very strange. Actually, I was all day, you know, in my mind, you know, I was going back to Georgia. Because, you know, I was very accustomed. Actually, I spent in Georgia, you know, so many years, you see, practically the same amount that I spent in Cuba, you
uh-huh.
see. Because, you know, it's more or less, you see, I came quite young, then, you know, 16 years is a lot of years in the life
sure.
of somebody, you see. Then for my daughter, you see, Georgia is home, because she doesn't remember Cuba, you see, Georgia is homeland for her. Actually, you know, she feels, it's very interesting, because it's a combination of feelings, you see, she's Georgian, she's American, and she's Cuban, not knowing what is Cuba, you see, to us, she's Cuban, but... You know, for her, all her childhood is Georgia, you see. It's the mountains, you know, the rivers, and the city, so many places, the parks, where all these dear places where we went so many times, you see, on weekends, and, you know, spend there the time, you know, playing around and seeing her collection of rocks, for example, when she was a little girl, she's from Georgia, and, you know, leaves, and so many things. Still, when I open boxes, you know, it's a whole life accumulated that... everything have to deal with Georgia because we stay there, even though we went, you know, to other places in summertime on vacation and all that through the country. But I mean, you know, Georgia is home for all of us.
Well, when you came back though to Miami, when you came to Miami after living in Georgia, mm-hmm. Were you surprised at how strong the Latin community was?
Yes, it was very different to the Miami actually I saw when I came in 62, you see. And at first it was a kind of cultural shock for me, because, you know, I was accustomed to a different type of life, and, you know, I don't know, it was very, very hard for me to get accustomed to, for example, certain type of disorder that I see, disorganization, actually, you know, people are not so effective in so many offices and places. You go and you have to wait a lot for things, and I'm not accustomed. You see, I was living in a different type of environment. This bothers me a lot. Mm-hmm. And then, for example, I find that people are extremely aggressive driving, which I'm not accustomed, you see, or I wasn't accustomed. Now, of course, I'm accustomed. Mm-hmm. Thank God I haven't become aggressive joining the majority. But anyway, you know, it's I like to obey traffic laws, and, you know, people seem to be very impatient when I do this in here. But, you know, it was hard at the beginning. But, you see, I noticed something very interesting going on in Miami, actually. It's a kind of revival for the best, you see. People are getting aware of the very good things the Cuban community have, and, you know, they are trying to actually improve, you know, in the best possible way, not only economically. Now I see a cultural awareness in people that is extremely important. You see, for the first time, even politically, Cubans are united. Getting united. Actually, interesting enough, this is a phenomenon that happened simultaneously, because what happened in the Peruvian embassy, that, you know, almost 11,000 Cubans, you know, took that place in protest and, you know, trying to escape. It happened simultaneously in here in Miami. The revolutionary organizations got together, mentioning something for the first time. Instead of their own individual organizations, they were actually getting united around one big cause, Cuba, which is something extremely interesting that never before happened, you see, which, you know, in my opinion, Castro, of course, that knows very well what is going on in Miami, notice, and perhaps this is one of the reasons that he, in a hurry, decide, you know, to actually push this exodus, mass exodus, to destroy this that was going on here.
It seemed like he wanted to get as much bad publicity out as he could about that, like saying that he was going to just open the mental institutions and open mm-hmm. the jails and let
yes,
just
to destroy the faith of people in the goodness of Cubans. You see, that's what he did. And he succeeded, but I mean, temporarily, but no doubt it, he has succeeded. But, you know, I don't see that as a permanent condition, because what existed before the exodus is going to emerge again, mm-hmm. because Cubans now has a kind of awareness that they didn't have before. They are realizing so many things that, you know, they never before noticed, culturally especially. You see, actually, in my opinion, the only way to do something effective against Castro is creating an ideological front. We have here the elements. There are so many intelligent people living here. Our best writers are in exile, are not living in Cuba. And all this, you know, put together could create what could destroy Castro. Actually, in the world opinion, Castro nowadays is nobody. It will take a long time for people to, you know, completely become aware of the instruments that we have here in our hands. But we have actually a bomb. You see, we have a time bomb in our hands. It's a matter of knowing how to manage effectively what we have. You see, we have very intelligent people. And these people realize, you see, what we could do.
Right.
This, you know, this could become a tremendous, you see, force that will go out. This force has come to us from outside. And actually, the mass of people in Miami do not realize that. But it's important.
I am here. She's here, too. The both of you are here.
Hello.
You're interviewing her,
too. Oh, that's okay. We were talking about the Cuban immigration mm-hmm. today, which was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Do you see already in Miami? Has there been an effect on the community because of this immigration? Is there more of a cohesiveness, a more united front, or are people divided as to how they feel about all the new people coming?
I see in general, you know, that Cubans has the same opinion of any responsible citizen. You see, they are worried about the quality of Cubans that are coming. And one thing I have heard a lot constantly is that, you know, not because they are Cubans, we agree with the idea that, you know, of having criminals here. They are very scared about that. But as today, for example, today's paper appears, you know, a statement, I don't remember who did it, but somebody very important in you know, U.S. government, immigration, actually, that said that only Castro have distorted the image of the exodus by, you know, saying that anti-social and actually criminals are coming when only 800 has come. Actually, it's a very small percent when over 1,000, I don't know exactly the figure, but over 100,000 Cubans are already here, and only 800 out of this big amount are actually proven criminals, you see, or people that we do not want in this country. But in general, you know, everybody feels that Cubans are going to be, you know, contributing to USA in the same fashion and manner that the ones before have done it. Mm-hmm. Actually, one thing that, you know, gave me a lot of hope was a little group that went to Texas, and, you know, they went with a group of Mexican Americans, and, you know, the Mexicans were making fun of them. They were placed in a church in an old building, a falling apart building, and, you know, these Mexican Americans were making fun of them, and, you know, actually the Cubans said, give us a week and we will be on our own. You know, that gave me a lot of hope because, you know, people who has come to a country, they don't know the language, they don't know the elements in the new society, and they have the courage, you know, to have faith in themselves and thinking that as soon as, you know, they have a chance, they will be on their own, you know, give you an idea of the type of people that are coming. And these are not intellectuals, these are just normal human beings from the mass of people, you see. In addition, there are a lot of good intellectuals that have left the country in this, you know, exodus, you see. One name, you know, that we know is Reynaldo Arenas, who perhaps is one of the best Spanish writers of the moment, you see. And then right. That actually compensates, you see.
Yes.
If we only, you know, could actually mention one good factor, he's enough to compensate for whatever bad Castro sent us, you see. We know that now we have the privilege of having in this country, you know, a writer of his caliber, then, you know, that is enough. At least in my opinion, you know, I know what you can do with words much more than with guns, you see.
Right.
Then.
Do you think most people will come back and settle in Miami, or are they...
Miami's Mecca, you see, for
yes.
Cubans. Then, you know, it's a nice feeling, you see, when you come and you actually see that other countrymates, you know, have been able to establish economically and all that. But as I said, you see, I see something emerging in Miami. The period of economic preoccupation is over, even though, you know, we are perhaps at the doors of a recession or inflation or whatever you want, or, you know, we had a bad economic time, but it's not peculiar of USA. This is all over the world. You know, even though people are worried about the economic situation of the country as a whole, you see, Cubans have succeeded economically, and now is the moment in which Cubans are, you know, actually getting preoccupied about something else, culture, you see. And this is a big moment for the exile, you see, because this means that we are integrating in other levels, which is much more important, you see, to change the image, the kind of mediocre image that we had before here, you see.
Well, I think actually the Cuban community that was established had already proven that by establishing businesses and Little Havana took a pretty much decaying part of the mm-hmm. city and turned it into a thriving marketplace. And mm-hmm. so the Cuban population who were here had already kind of made, self-made mm-hmm. people who had come up again, mm-hmm. having come
sure.
over with nothing and then had established themselves, which mm-hmm. which I think was not lost on most people. Even though whenever you have two cultures meeting, you have there is always friction, mm-hmm. you know, between some people. But I think that had, at least the feeling I got from being in Miami and talking to both Anglos and Latins was that that was pretty much, it had really settled down, most of the real bad friction that had settled down in my life.
That's my opinion too, before the Exodus. You see, now we actually, Castro did very well, believe me. People,
yeah.
You know, he's aware of all these things. We gain a lot as far as relationships, you see, good relationship with other members of the community. And now we went some steps back, but we are going to go ahead again. You see, actually, you see, because of the Cuban presence mainly in Miami, you know, for the first time, this is one of the big contributing factors. You see, since 1976, the balance of trade of USA was against, you see, the country, and now it's favorable of USA. And actually, one of the contributing factors is the Latin community of Miami. And if we take into account that the majority of the population here is Cuban, Cuban have played a big role in this. Then you know the actually business that Cubans attract from Latin America is amazing. You see, it's fascinating to see these multimillionaires coming here. If we check, for example, how many banks at the moment are owned by foreign capital, you see the majority of these people is nine banks in the city of Miami owned by foreigners, and the majority of these banks are owned by Latin Americans that never before decided to invest here. Now they do. Because you see, they have a receptive community that speak their own language and know their idiosyncrasy and can communicate in terms that are pleasant to them, you see.
Right.
Then this is a factor. You see, eventually this exodus will become a regular population, you see. And I foresee, you know, a big, big economic, you know, development in the city, taking into account that we are getting people that, you see, are in their best productive years. And they are already formed as laborers. And you see, this is important. Some of them are laborers, some of them are professional. And you know, these people are already made. We
mm-hmm.
don't have to spend a single penny in preparing them. It's
right.
a matter of teaching them the language and teaching them certain things that you have to know in a foreign country or a foreign culture to be able to move, and they will be here joining, you know, the economic force of the you know, nation. Then in my particular opinion, my private opinion, I don't see that this is going to be, it's a transitional, you know, situation that we have. As soon as, you know, we can establish certain patterns, this is going to be for the best.
Oh, I think so. I was trying to think of what makes Miami unique as far as being a Cuban community. One of the things I noticed was that there do seem to be a lot of traditions that are alive in Miami, that were alive in Cuba. For instance, when you were in Cuba, I know you were of probably an upper middle class family, upper class or middle class.
I don't know how to classify, but it's hard to classify because you know the
right.
economic levels in Latin America
so
are
different.
You see,
right? Okay.
My father works for an American company, as I said, and he has he owns a small business, you know, like electric appliances business.
Mm-hmm.
That was all he had.
Well, did you have a quinceañera when you were 15?
No, I didn't like the idea.
Oh, really?
I was an odd Cuban.
What?
You
yes,
know, I was a kind of
is,
odd Cuban. Because, you see, that is a phenomenon of the exile. You know, people have the tendency to make myth out of, you know, what was their past. And, you know, I when I was in Cuba, actually, it was not something that was part of the life of every Cuban. You see,
no.
we celebrate our 15th the same way we celebrate any other birthday. You know, sometimes with a little bit more, you know, perhaps a little, you know.
Well, the quinceañera would have been, the quinceañera in, as it was practiced in Cuba, was just for the very few wealthy families who would have a very sedate coming out party. Is that what it was?
No, I mean, quinceañeras were, of course, celebrations that, you know, high society people had, you see, but also middle class people had it, and everybody celebrated, you know, birthdays, except that it was not that, it didn't play an important part, such an important part in the life of, you know, young people like it is here. But in here, it has an explanation. You see, it's normal that when people leave their own, you know, custom and their own culture, they somehow try to recapture what was, you know, left behind. And of course, through years, you see visions get distorted. You see, it's like when you go, for example, you are born in a place, and then you go someplace else and grow up in some other place, and then, you know, you keep memories of the place in which you were born, and then, you know, when after you become an adult, you go back to your, you know, hometown, and then, you know, you confront reality, and you see, for example, that the house that in your mind is a big, big place, and, you know, beautiful place, is just a little place, you see, you know how it is. Then this is actually the vision. So many Cubans, for example, has enlarged, deformed, distort this kind of idea. In addition, Fiesta de 15, in my opinion, represents a kind of, you know, proof of the economic success or power of them. It's a proof, you know, it's something they need for their own security. They have to do that as a way to prove to themselves that they can afford it, you see, that they have, after all, they have made it, you see, in the new culture. This is a kind of nice feeling that they have to have. But notice, like in my case, for example, I grew up in Cuba, and I didn't want to have a Fiesta de 15. All the relatives of mine had it, but I didn't like such a thing. You know, then my sister didn't like it either. Then we didn't have it, and we were young, and we lived in the 50s, which was the period, you know, of nostalgia and all that, or actually not nostalgia, but the period of innocent life, you know, in which these things were very much on fashion, but we didn't care for such a thing. Then, you know, it was not, actually, we were normal teenagers at the time, you see. And I had so many friends that never had it. We had just a little thing among friends, and that's all.
But here in Miami, do most young girls want to have a quinceañera?
I think, you know, young girls that belong to certain type of social, you know, level. These type of people, yes, they identify that, you know, with an element that is very important, perhaps in showing success or actually, you know, giving themselves a kind of identity that they would like to have. You see, some, after all, this is a proof, you know, we are people, we are somebody, we can have such a, you know, perhaps a big power, you know. But it's not necessarily what everybody believes, you see. Except that we have in here a big accumulation of certain social level, you see. Actually, if you talk to Clark, you know, and you check what he have done, you will realize how interesting is the composition of the Cuban exile, and it will give you, you know, actually figures and facts about, you know, why these things could happen, you see. It's a big concentration of blue collars here. It's very interesting.
And would the blue collar people be interested in perhaps having a quinceañera to show that they
Because this means, you know, we have made it. You see, we have the money to afford it.
In Cuba, they wouldn't have been able to.
No, because they didn't need to prove anything.
Right.
After all, they were in a culture that they control the elements, you see.
Right.
That's the thing.
I'm going to have to talk to him because that's neat. Well, what I was thinking also about things that I saw in the Cuban community here, which must give kind of a feeling of home, like, of course, the Cuban food. It seems like you have almost every kind of food that you could have had in Cuba is cooked here, and you can, there's hundreds of restaurants and grocery stores that supply those ingredients that, say, if you went to Atlanta, you probably wouldn't be able to find all the ingredients to make certain Cuban dishes.
No, Atlanta have improved a lot, you see.
Yeah.
They have places where you can buy these things now.
If you went to my town, where I live in a little small community where there are
no
Latins,
more complicated.
You wouldn't be able to get plantains and black beans. And
or any of the tropical fruits or any, you know.
Nothing. So, so that, I was thinking, was something that and especially the Cuban Cafe Cubano, where you can just, it gives me a feeling, I love it because it gives me a feeling of being in a foreign country without being in a foreign country, because nowhere else have I seen where you can go up to a little shop window and order your coffee and drink it on the street and then go on, which is, it gives you a feeling of being in Latin America, you know, because I know that's probably how it was done in Latin America.
You know, perhaps I can, you know, tell you my impression of Cuban coffee. You know, when I get home, the first thing I do is that, you know, fix coffee, because I always said, now home smells like home.
Oh, right.
You see?
Yes.
You know, it's something, uh-huh. You know, that smell, you know, is very important, because, uh-huh. You know, somehow it gives you the feeling that, you know, it's home, you see?
Uh-huh.
It's something that's so familiar, you see, since
uh-huh.
You were born, you smell
you
that,
smell
you see? Early in the morning, all the time, during the day, anytime company comes,
mm-hmm.
You see, then, you know, it's very important. These
it
little
is.
Things in actually help a lot, you see, to actually to adapt and to be able to survive, you know, these sad days that everybody have when, you know, leave his culture or her culture behind.
Right. Now, the other thing that I noticed, and I don't know if this is an accurate observation or not, you might be able to tell me. I noticed that everything seems to be bigger and better in Miami, if you know what I mean. Like
mm-hmm.
The pinata shop that I went
mm-hmm.
to. Those pinatas were the most elaborate and beautiful
mm-hmm.
pinatas I've ever seen. They were just, you know, the La Casa de la Pinata
mm-hmm.
with all the
mm-hmm.
Different themes. And then the bakeries have such
mm-hmm.
Elaborate, beautiful
mm-hmm.
cakes and
mm-hmm.
very elaborate kinds of cookies and things that look delicious and just, you know, very elaborate, I guess. And then the baby shops.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed all the frills and the beautiful needlework
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
Things that seem to be. Very. I don't know if are they different from what a bakery and pinata shop and a baby shop would be have been in Cuba, or are they carryovers?
No, they are carryovers, except that we still don't get here the genuine version, because in Cuba, for example, there were stores for babies that were the most wonderful things you can imagine. You
really?
Can find the most fantastic, you know, things. Like, we had one very famous in Havana called La Cigüeña de París, the stock from Paris. And, you know, that actually is a Spanish, you know,
uh-huh.
from Spain. In Madrid there is one, you know, big store. It was owned by the same people. And actually, you know, what you could find in these places is, you know, some things that could be worn by, you know, by, you might say, a princess or a king,
uh-huh.
You see, beautiful things, because you know how important children are for us, you see, they are the center of our whole life, you
right.
See. Then for us to dress up children, you know, actually babies in a very good, you know, fashion is something extremely important. We feel very proud of our children, and we like to, you know, show or present them in the best, you know, possible way. And, you know, still, we don't have yet, you know, stores of such quality, you
absolutely,
see.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's normal, because, you know, the economic development, you know, is not the same, even though there is, at the moment, a large amount of Cubans who, you know, has a very prosperous economy. Not everybody in general has
right.
that. Then that was very common, you see. I just mentioned, you know, the top store, but there were so many other stores, not as famous, but very, very good stores. And, you know, as far as, you know, piñatas houses and things like that, they were in Havana, beautiful places, you
yeah.
see, where you can buy the most beautiful things, because, you know, children for us are very important. And
yes.
we have our, you know, stores actually show our interest, you know, it's a
uh-huh.
reflection of what we actually like. Stores, you know, Cuban stores are not similar, you see. They are similar in a way to certain areas, like, for example, what we call Habana Vieja or Havana. They are little places that remind you a lot of these places, but still, you know, we haven't had any of the big, big stores like,
right.
you know, the one we used to have in Havana, very elegant and very distinguished
right.
and all that. But, you know, life is different, you see,
right.
and there are so many good American stores that, you know, it's not necessary to create. Maybe someday one of these people would come, and out of nostalgia, they will have one of these big stores. But, you know, it's something
well,
that I don't think is very much needed, because you can find, you know, good stuff in other places. Except that perhaps the little boutiques substitute the European taste of Cubans, you see, that is
right.
more, we love American things, you know, during the daytime. And then we like to dress up at evening, European style.
Right.
because right. American things are very practical, you know,
right,
very nice to keep and,
but
you know, all that. But, you know, life is different in this country, and this perhaps is a reflection of one of the adaptations of Cubans, you see. Well, indeed.
I noticed, too, I have a good friend who's Cuban who lives up near me, and she has the most beautiful jewelry,
mm-hmm.
and that she said that was a tradition in her family that every birthday her mm-hmm. grandmother and mother would give her another piece of jewelry, which was almost like a hope chest kind of thing
mm-hmm.
for her of beautiful gold jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had never had that in my family, but I was wondering, is that pretty common?
Yes, it's very common.
Mm-hmm. I suppose since you had to leave all...
Yes,
your gold
you
in
leave.
Cuba, you
have
to start,
no,
start gathering again.
No, except that, you know, perhaps again, I'm an old Cuban here because I'm not very fond of Euro, you see, myself.
Yeah.
I only have a few little things and I'm not very fond of these things. Never like it. Not
uh-huh.
not even when I was in Cuba, you see.
Huh.
I always like to dress up in a very simple fashion
mm-hmm.
and wear the minimum amount of things.
Uh-huh.
You see, that type. I don't care too much for, you know, this type of thing. But of course, it's my personal preference. You see, I'm not representative of
right.
what, you know.
Right, different. But you would know that probably many Cuban families do put an emphasis on that.
Mm, oh, sure.
Well, actually,
I had some things when I was in Cuba that, you know, was given to me by my parents in my birthdays or graduations or things like that. Because this is tradition, you know,
right.
to do it. And then you pass these things to your daughter, so, you know, it goes from grandmothers
right.
to, you know, to granddaughters and that way. But, you know, this is tradition. But this,
right.
again, is European, too, you see.
Right. It is. It's more,
mm-hmm.
it's Spanish,
mm-hmm.
too. I know Spanish. And I guess the bakery it's pretty similar, the baked goods. Are they pretty similar to... the baked goods that were made in Havana
sure.
with
mm-hmm.
the meringue.
Yes,
I've never seen that before, the meringue flowers and things.
Oh, sure. That's similar. That's
uh-huh.
similar.
Okay.
And there were others, too, that we don't have in here that were, you know, famous places in Havana, too, where they had the most beautiful things,
mm-hmm.
you see, because this, what you see here is perhaps what is more part of the taste of the big mass of people, but
right.
in Havana you have places where you can find the most delicate things, you see, beautifully done,
uh-huh.
with in a very good taste, you see,
uh-huh.
and things that were actually, like, you might say, first prizes, you see, if they were in a contest, beautiful, beautiful things.
Well, I know before the revolution, when Havana was the like the show place of Latin America for people to go,
mm-hmm.
tourists to go, because it's a shop and things
mm-hmm.
like that, because they could get beautiful things.
Sure,
and
they were.
And I guess the economic situation, was, as you say, was the best
mm-hmm.
it had been. And the men's shirts with all the little...
Ah, guayaberas.
What do they call them?
Guayaberas.
Oh.
Guayaberas. There is one place here in Miami where you can buy, you know, the good ones, you see?
Right.
The ones that are very...
I stopped in there.
Uh-huh.
They're very...
It's on Calle Ocho.
Well done. And they're, very... well, they've got monograms on them sometimes, and they're all kind of handmade for the man.
But the real genuine kind is made out of linen. And, you know, it's very pretty. It could be white or kind of, you know, off-white. Or kind of very light beige, and you know, these are the traditional ones, and they are absolutely beautiful because they are all made by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it is a kind of garment that will be very hard to have, because you know, you have to know how to iron that. And of course, to send these to places where they iron, you know, special things, you know how expensive it could be. And this is something you only can put on one time, because
right.
you see, it wrinkles very easily.
Right.
And you know, it's you know, you cannot only, you can only wear it once. Then you
is
know
that,
what it means.
Right.
You
is
have
that
to be sent
like
constantly to the clinic.
Is that the kind of the dress shirt of that
in
was
tropic.
Worn in
yes.
It,
in you know, actually, this was something that you could wear to any place in the tropic. You see, because you know, Cuba is a tropical country and it's
right.
very hot. And, you know, to wear a suit sometimes is that you have to be a hero if you're a man to wear a suit, you know.
Yes.
And nowadays with air conditioning and all that, of course, the situation is different. In Cuba, there were so many, you know, places with air conditioning, but so many places in which, you know, you have to stand, you know, the weather, actually the hot weather. And, you know, it was horrible. And this, you know, this is fresher. And, you know, it's nice. It depends the material that was used. Sometimes, you know, it was used in a very good, a good quality of material was used, and you know it looked very elegant when it is well ironed, because it is an art to do that. I can I confess that I'm horrible.
I can never do it either.
No,
I can't even.
That's terrible.
But let's see, and the dominoes, now that to me, the domino park is something that's come over. That was a very popular game in Cuba.
Oh yes, it is.
And where it's stayed popular here.
Yes, it is.
And bolita, do you have?
No, bolita is illegal. It's something illegal.
Oh, okay, because it's got gambling.
Yes, that's gambling. But, you know, this is something that in Latin American countries as well as in Spain, they have lottery, which is officially, you know, patronized by the government.
Right.
Actually, in Cuba, whatever was obtained from this, the income obtained from this, this, you know, you might say, drawing contest, whatever, I don't know how to, you know, call such a thing, was donated to the officially, you see, the official, let's see how to call that, the official orphan, you know, place in Havana.
Yes.
You see, it was supported with the revenue that actually the government obtained from this sponsoring, you know, this type of thing,
of
game.
Yeah.
And, you know, people used to buy, you know, these things. And then bolita is something illegal. On Saturdays, there was, you know, when they draw the numbers for the loteria. And then the bolita was actually something that they took into account the last three numbers or the last number or the last two numbers of the official, you know, prices, and then they beat money. You see, they said, for example, $5 to that number, and then if you happen to, they happen to, you know, pick the number or get the number out, you see, because it was done by somebody blind, you know, somebody blind got the numbers, and it was done by radio, you see, every Saturday. Then they you know, they had a kind of illegal thing, but this was prohibited by the law. You see, it's not legal at all.
Grants can be the worst thing in the world, I know, because you have to plan so far in advance.
Mm-hmm, true.
And so the only other thing that I had noticed that had really become, I guess, more popular here is Santeria. Because it is very...
Santeria here is... I would say that it's more popular in here than it used to be in Cuba. You see, again, I have my own idea about that, you see. In my opinion, perhaps the reason that this has become, you know, so important in the life of so many Cubans is that it is perhaps the only element that is only Cuban, you see. Because the Catholic religion, which is a religion practiced by a majority of Cubans, is something that the Cubans coming here, you see, can find in the American community. But, you know, the only genuine Cuban thing that they actually can bring with them is this.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps for certain elements of the population, you know, this is a kind of, it has some kind of a special connotation, you see, as far as giving them a security, dealing with elements that are, you know, closer to them, because
mm-hmm.
they come from their native land. You see, it's interesting, because that in Cuba was not known the way it is here.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, for example, in my childhood, that I used to see people dressed up in white, but I mean, this was the exception. You know, certain ladies, especially black ladies, but I mean, it was not, you know, so popular that you see that everywhere like you see here.
Mm-hmm.
And botanicas, I don't recall any. I never have seen any, you see, in Cuba. I know that in Guanabacoa and some places in Havana, near Havana and in Havana, these things exist, but it was not open to, you know, to actually in the open, you know, it was kind of hiding. But in here, notice how the proliferation of this is amazing, you see. Actually, when I went to New Jersey, one of the first time I went, I was looking for books, and then I saw bookstore and, you know, reading Spanish, and I got in that place. I went into this place. And then, you know, I started looking around, and I saw that I was in a very strange place, full of objects that were unfamiliar. You see, uh-huh. I didn't recognize these things, like two rings and, you know, these mm-hmm. kind of things. And then when I turned, actually, this was, like, in my right side. And when I turned left, I saw a lot of books. And then when I started looking at the titles, they were, like things, spiritism, and, you know, things like that. Then, my God, you know, I said to myself, my goodness, where in the world I am? You know, this is not the place I'm looking for. This is not a regular bookstore. Then I just, you know, courteously say thank you, and I left, because, you know, this place, I never, you know, had seen these things in Cuba before, you see.
Right.
And I was very familiar with the bookstores in Havana, you know, and that was not common, you see, at all in the island. And I knew of the existence of this, but it was kind of mysterious to the majority of the population. Even though a lot of people now, I have found out, that has practiced this, you know, behind doors, you see. They didn't confess openly that they believe in these things. Now they openly say it, so many people, that they said, you know, I have been in this for years and years and years, but that was not something openly, you know,
right.
expressed in Cuba or actually practiced it openly. This was more actually part of daily life for blacks or for certain low-class population in Cuba.
Right.
And some people were interested in that, but from a folkloric, you know, or anthropological, you see, point of view. Like, you know, Lydia Cabrera, of course,
right.
you know, all her life, she has dedicated all her life to that, or Fernando Ortiz, her brother-in-law, you know, these scholars were all their life studying this, and, you know, so many other people, but I mean, this was only of the interest of certain special people,
right.
this type of interest. Otherwise, you know, it was practiced only by certain segment of the population, but not
and
as in here.
In
it has become something very common here, you
right.
see, very common.
Even in New York and Miami.
And in Puerto Rico, too. Actually
right.
exported by Cubans. It's very interesting.
That's
Cubans
interesting.
Took
so
that
it's
over
now
there.
Down.
Actually, it's very interesting because Cubans brought these from Cuba to Miami, to Puerto Rico, to New Jersey, and New York, and California.
That's amazing because...
This is...
Well, I know. And in Tampa, they have several botanicas
mm-hmm.
I've noticed, too, which
mm-hmm.
is... really interesting because, it's, since you say in Cuba it wasn't that. I wonder how, for instance, the new immigrants will react to that. It'll be very strange, I'm sure, because I wonder what's been happening in the past 20 years under Castro's regime. For instance, with the communist regime, I imagine they are not used to now the very fine piñatas and the bakery items and the very fine needlework things and miniatures.
Some of them remember these things, you see, because they still, you know, these things, when they are done by hand, they last, you know, forever. And you see, like baby's clothes, for example, you can
right.
pass it, you see, from generation to generation, and they last. But you see, some people, still some families in Cuba, you know, have kept these things, but, you know, to use these things or to wear these things daily is quite complicated because they don't even have soap to, you know, wash
oh,
things
right.
with. Then, you know, they have actually these things hidden, they don't use. They use whatever is the most practical, you know, thing. They notice that it takes, you know, it takes so much time, and actually you have to iron and, you know, all these things. Then they need, you know, like starch, they need to actually restore the you know, brand new appearance of these materials and all that. But, you know, it, actually, what I have, you know, gathered from whatever, you know, I have asked to the new refugees that I have been talking to, they said that, you know, so many of the things, like especially dealing with Santeria, this is not so popular in Cuba now. This is done, but it practices, but in a very, very hidden way, as it used to be before, because that's one of the things the government prohibited, you know, the practice of any religion. There is one religion, the state religion, you know, communism, then they don't believe in any other thing. Even though I heard that Castro is one of the initiators in the religion, that's what I heard. And there are some pictures that have been seen in papers
uh-huh.
here, you know, showing Castro this up in Y and all that. I don't know if it is true or not, but anyway, the picture
uh-huh.
is there, and perhaps it's true that now, you know, he feels a little bit less secure, and he's, you know, trying
to... He better start casting spells, getting the
favor of some, you know, other gods. But anyway, perhaps. But, you know, they are overwhelmed in the majority of cases. They are discovering, like, the other day I was in a house of a... you know, two new refugees, and they were actually playing in the kitchen like little boys. You see, they said, look at these lights turn, and then you can see, you see this stuff. And then they said, look at this fan that it has here. This is fascinating. I was, you know, delighted looking at them, seeing this, you know, having this adventure. Then another thing that called very much their attention is the fan, the exhausted fan in the bathroom.
Yes.
They said, this is so interesting. Anytime you turn the light on, this goes on too. Then, you know, it's fascinating to see, you know. Then everything calls their attention, vacuum cleaners, you know, the smaller things, that yogurt. He was eating yogurt. And then I said, do you like yogurt? That's nice. Then he said, yes. Then he showed me the carton. Then I said, oh, that's apricot. Then, you know, I told him in Spanish what it means. He said, what is that? Then I said, don't you? Then he didn't know. He never have, you know, heard of such a fruit in Cuba.
Oh.
You see, no, because, you know, these things are imported, you see. Then they don't have this type of, you know, commodities there. These are for the taste of, you know.
Right, I was
people.
Wondering about the food too. Like, there have been food shortages in
Oh
Cuba.
Sure, for a long time,
wow,
since the beginning
right.
of the revolution.
And I wonder if maybe because of that, some of the traditional recipes have been lost because they can't get the ingredients.
Oh, they are very ingenious in there. For example, one of they had a show like Julia Chow here.
Yeah.
They have one in there, you see. And then they said that it's fascinating to see this woman who actually is she's in favor of the revolution, you know, trying to use the best of her imagination to come up with gourmet recipes, not having ingredients. Then I wish I could see that, because that should be probably proof of tremendous genius, you see.
Oh, yes, I can imagine. Well, especially, say, if there is a shortage of meat or chicken or things,
you know,
like
they, I don't know what kind of, they eat whatever they can obtain. Prices are unbelievable, then not all the time they can obtain, you know, because everything's in black market to begin with. Then, you know, whatever they can obtain, they buy it, but, you know, it's their diet has been reduced to the minimum. You see, most of the things they eat is starch. You see, because
like beans and rice.
Yes,
right.
Beans and rice, and, you know, bread, and, you know, things like that, of that sort.
And then, because it would be very hard to keep up all of the, like, some of the recipes, like the old clothes, like ropa viejo.
Ropa vieja. Oh, no. You know, they don't have tomato. They have natural tomatoes, but fresh tomatoes, but, you know, when they can find it. You see, Cuba...
Meat
is hard. Cuba actually goes by harvest. You see, sometimes what they have is tomatoes. Then they saturate the market with tomatoes. Then tomatoes are gone, and then something else comes. But they don't have everything at the same time,
uh-huh.
or all at the same time. They
right.
have one product. And then it's the time to eat tomatoes. Then people eat tomatoes until it comes out of their ears,
yeah.
you see. Then when that is over, they get something else. But that's the way it goes in there, you see.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, like in any other normal, you know, country,
right.
which actually production is planned.
Right.
Even though they are always talking about plans, that doesn't exist.
Right.
It's crazy, you see. They don't have an organized economy
yeah.
in the way, you know, that is organized in other countries. But it's fascinating, for example, to see the reaction of them. I had, you know, one that went to my house. I invite him to come, and, you know, I offer him Coca-Cola with rum, which is something so popular, you know, in Cuba. We call it Cuba Libre. And then he kept saying, how delicious. He just insisted. You see, the conversation was going on, and he said, how delicious. This is delicious. And, you know, he kept saying this, because for years and years he never tried that, you see. It was gone from the... You see, then, you know, it's fascinating. It's really interesting, because even those that were there before, I mean, that, you know, didn't grow up with the revolution or actually were old enough to remember things before, you see, they feel, you know, overwhelmed with so many things. They can't believe. One thing that fascinates them is computers, you see, and Xerox machines. They can't believe, you know, the big magic of, you know, getting a paper and getting coppers, you know, on both sides and things like that. It's really interesting, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the toll-free numbers is another thing that they can't believe that exists. Yeah. And, you know, so many things that we take for granted, you see, they feel fascinated, you know.
Uh-huh, yeah, because I imagine the technology is not...
It's non-existent.
Right.
They don't have this kind of thing. They never have seen, you know, things the way we have it here. Like, for example, making reservations and cancellations and whatever you want and changes and all that in minutes by phone. You see, that doesn't exist here.
Yeah.
You know, it's something unbelievable. In first place, you know, you are not allowed to travel. Then who's going to think about, you know, reservations or cancellations? But these things fascinate them, you see. Papers, you know, how many type of different papers we have to write that they don't have. Typewriters is something that they can't believe. You know, the IBM's electric, you know, something of that sort. Is the actually high fidelity or, you know, equipment, you know, they are fascinated, you know, things. Everything is like a new world for them.
When the refugees are coming in, you have a center for them to kind of get them settled?
They came, you know, since it was something that nobody expected. You see, there was not so much time to, you know, to create things. But, I mean, with resources, you see, in the city, actually everything has functioned beautifully. And now they are getting, like, classes, you see, to somehow guide them into the new culture. You see, explaining simple things as, for example, banking. They don't have an idea because this is not part of the Cuban economy. Then they don't know what it is, credit cards, what it is. You know, these things that are very simple for us, but I mean unbelievable, strange for them because, you know, for example, when they never have seen credit cards, you see, some of them, and then they can't believe such a thing. They said, but can you pay with that? What do you do? Then, you know, I said, you only show that, and they write down, you know, these notice the numbers that they have that stick out, and then they, you know, have some kind of sort of ink that, you know, print this, and then you only sign it. But then he said, is that the same as money? Then I said, yes, exactly the same. The only thing is that, you know, the payment is deferred. You pay it later, but it's the same. That, you know, this is a new concept of economy that is completely unknown to them. You know, the consumer society in which we live is a reality that they had.
We just
they
take
never
it for
had.
Granted because we grew up with it and we've had it for so long and yet, yeah, I can see how it'd be very confusing.
It is extremely confusing. Sometimes, like in one particular case that I'm thinking, you know, perhaps it's a very smart person, you know, extremely smart, except that, you know, he has been completely isolated of what is going on in the world. And it's fascinating to see his reaction. Sometimes, you know, he said to me, I have been in contact with him lately a lot. And then, you know, he said, I still feel completely out of place. He said, I'm not quite sure if I'm here. That's what he keeps repeating, you know. He said, I need time because this is too much. It's so overwhelming that I cannot assimilate all at once, you know. It's so much. Then he gets sometimes kind of dispersed. You see, he said, for example, you know, I, for example, he said yesterday to me, I already have my social security number on my card. Then I said, yes, I know. You told me 2 days ago. He said, did I? I completely forget. Then, you know, he doesn't have so many people to talk to. But you see, he's still, you see, in the process of getting accustomed to, he's like a little boy, you see, with that card, you know, because it's something. You know, he realizes that with that he can work, you see. And he, you know, he didn't have it before. He has to wait because there are so many in process.
There's so many, yes. My goodness. Well, 100,000 in a couple of months is just...
unbelievable.
Yeah. You know. And so they're having to, like, do overtime.
In less than 2 months, you see. In less than 2 months.
Yeah,
we have over,
it was unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
I don't think Castro thought that would happen.
I think, you know, he needed, because he's now having a horrible time in Cuba. For example, this is what I, you know, gathered from the information that I have gathered from the people coming. For example, for the first time in the history of the revolution, you are seeing graffiti in the streets. People are writing, you see, against the government. Then, for example, the city of Havana one morning, you know, was full of crabs, you know, with something written under, you know, cover. They said, according to, you know, the myth, crabs walk backwards instead of ahead. And then they said, we walk like the revolution backwards. you see, protests of that sort, you see, written on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it was a ridiculous situation because the police, you see, was actually getting the cops as prisoners, you know, trying to find as the proof, you see, of their, you know, crime.
Oh, no.
And, you know, people were actually, you know, laughing like crazy because it's a ridiculous situation. You see where they have, you know, gathered. Then another thing that appeared in one of the neighbors of Havana was an old horse and said, "Don't push me, I will fall by myself," you know, in reference to Fidel, that is called El Caballo, you know, the horse.
Oh, yes.
And then, you know, things like that. Another sign appears in Havana, you know, cemetery, and said, "Fidel, welcome. This is your house." You know, you see.
Oh, so he's really having a hard
situation. Internally, the situation is quite, you know, people are actually so oppressed that they can hold any longer, you see. Then when they decide to go in mass to an embassy, you see, he announced it by radio that the guards were taken, you know, away from the embassy. And he thought that he would perhaps create a problem, you see, to the Peruvians. But he never expected, I'm sure, you see, such a big mass of people getting there. And then it was, you know, something that everybody was running, you see, to get into the embassy. And, you know, it's an unbelievable thing. You see,
yeah.
They have reached you know, it's 20 years of promises, you see, and no
yes.
realities, you see.
And not, yeah, and 20 mm-hmm. years is a long time.
20 years is a long time, you see, especially for young people. Actually, I spoke to a doctor that told me that the rate of suicide in young people is about 100 a month in the city of Havana.
Oh.
Very young people commit suicide constantly. You see, 100 is a lot in a city, you see, in
yes.
young people. Because they have no hope, you see.
Yeah.
It's like
how they grew up within
the system, you see. Actually, they are very,
and
very young.
They
you
don't
see.
Know that there could be
They
hope.
Don't know anything better, but at the same time, they know that that is not good at all, you see. Then we're young.
Hasta aquí toda tarde.
Okay. And then, you know, it's an interesting, you know, symbol, you see, or perhaps, you know, yes, you might say, you know, a signal of what is going on in the city.
Yeah.
Or actually in the country.
It's very interesting. It'd be very interesting to see what Castro's reaction will be now that, you know, there are just 100,000 people left.
No, he needed. That's escape.
Oh, I see.
That's
he needed,
a way
he
to
needed
to
the
calm.
People to leave so that
sure.
he
sure. You notice that any time a person is planning to leave, you see, somehow that person calmed down, you see, because at least that person has a hope, you see, and that is enough. Man needs hope to live, you see.
Right.
When you have a hope, you strive for that. You actually concentrate all your energy in whatever you are doing. And then, you know, in that direction, and then you feel somehow, you know, distracted from other things. And then that's what he accomplishes anytime he does that, you see. It's a way to give some relief, some escape to people, you see.
Right.
Then that's a political instrument, you see, to calm people down.
Well, he did it.
Yes, certainly.
Yeah, but
he did it. But now, you know, he has a large group of people, you know, that have been separated from the relative, and now, you know, the whole process will
start
all over again.
Well,
but at least he will get some years or perhaps months, or I hope months,
right.
or relief.
Well, it's so funny. There is a cartoon that showed Castro in it, talking to someone and saying, "Of course the revolution's a success. We have this and this and this." And then he says, "The only thing we don't have is Cubans." And
no.
They all laugh.
I heard a joke that was very funny. They said that Castro was wondering, you know, the big
uh-huh.
lines that in every place, you know, stores and drug stores and every place, you know, it's a line for to obtain whatever you need. And then he said, "You know, I wonder, I never have been in one of these lines. Let me go and join one of these and see what it is to be in a line." And then, you know, when he starts, you know, stand in line there, people start moving, getting out, and then, you know, he wondered why people are leaving. Then, you know, suddenly he asked, you know, one of the people in front of him, "Why people are leaving?" They said, "Commander, if you are, you know, this is immigration line, and since you're leaving, they decide to stay." You know,
well, that's so funny.
That, you know, that's the, you
oh,
know,
that's
the way it is. You see, since
uh-huh.
he leave, nobody, you know, it's no reason to leave the country, you see. He's
well,
the,
This is interesting, but I guess the Cuban community here is pretty much united now where it wasn't before. I mean, are there still pro-Castro people in
Oh,
Miami?
Sure. There are certain people. You see, there are certain, you know, groups.
Working.
Yes, they are two big names that, you know, sound a lot. I mean, not a lot, but I mean, you know, they are the most active groups. One is called Areito, and the other one is called Brigada Antonio Maceo. And these two groups are formed by people who still believe in Castro.
Hmm. Why don't they go back?
They have been, but you know, they haven't been treated probably as native. You see, that's the reason when you go and visit a communist country, you are taken to show places, you see.
Uh-huh.
But the important thing is to live to in your own, or actually to experience on your own flesh, you see, what
right.
it is to be persecuted, and you know what it is to not to be able to express your opinion, or because of your opinions to be actually, you know, persecuted
right.
and crucified in so many cases, you see.
Right.
That's terrible. But you know, these people sometimes lack perspective, you see. They don't realize, you know, the historical
right.
moment that, you know, Latin America is living and Cuba has with a system that have nothing to do with our idiosyncrasy, you see.
No.
Social not, you know, type of thing in the history of, you know, New World.
Right.
It has nothing to do, it's nothing in common with us. You see, we belong to the Western European tradition. We have nothing to do with communism. It has nothing for us. You see,
yeah.
America is free land.
Right.
It's the land of freedom. Actually, where everybody have come to find, you know, so many wonderful things, then a system like that, you know, actually frame you
uh-huh.
in a way that you cannot think, you cannot move, it's not a system for America, you
right.
see.
Right.
It's no system for any place in the world, because I think, you know, the only thing that a human being needs to live, besides, you know, air and water and food, is freedom, you see.
Yeah.
After you, actually, when you, the physical things can be covered, you know, in a very unpretentious way, but freedom is the essential thing, you
right.
see. Without that, you cannot live.
I know, and I think people take it for granted when they grow up in it, and they don't realize really how wonderful it is. And it takes a lot of people coming in to remind them that, you know, they
mm-hmm.
had to flee because and go away from their country.
But sad enough, a lot of people do not realize that yet.
Yeah,
it is very,
I know.
Very sad.
It is.
That they don't see, you see, what it means when a whole, you know, mass of people decide to, you know, such a big exodus, what it means, you see. They don't realize that. They see the bad, you know, angle of that. They see that these people are coming and they will be taking jobs away. They don't
oh,
realize,
yes.
you know, the other part,
there's
which
a
is
lot of
actually
conflict.
A statement,
yes.
a very strong political statement in this situation, you see.
Which says, this is
by
the
itself
system.
Explains, you
right.
see, what is going on in Cuba, you see. I don't think wars are necessary in this case, you see, except that some people unfortunately need wars, you see,
yeah.
they have to be reminded of what is going on in Cuba, how
right.
cruel, only 90 miles from here, you see, we have one of the most cruel system that you can imagine, you see, where
right.
human life have no value, you see.
It's
sad. I don't know if it is true, but it was, you know, a friend of mine, her mother went to Cuba, and when she was coming back in the boat that she was coming, the government insisting placing some, you know, insane people. They were completely crazy. They were in the middle of a crisis. And then, you know, they actually request from the Cuban authorities to remove them because they were not in condition whatsoever of being taken here. And then the government insists, they said, either you take them or you stay. Or we actually don't, you know, then they decide to take the two, you know, crazy men with, you know, going through a crisis. And then when they were already, you know, out of the coast, the Coast Guard from Cuba came and they said, just, you know, throw them in the water. And then the captain of the boat actually said, I won't do such a thing. Then they went themselves and took the two crazy, you know, men and threw them in the water, and they, of course, you know, drowned in there. And I heard that the captain is here in a hospital, you see, in a nervous, you know, with a nervous breakdown because he can, you know, recover from the memories of seeing these two men die and you sitting there.
That's terrible.
It is possible because, you know, this was told.
Yeah.
A friend of mine told me, you know, her mother saw this. Then I don't have a reason not to believe it. But, you know, it seems like such a big monstrosity.
Oh, I know it. How
but, I mean, you know, anything can be, you know, put in doubt it because, you know.
And then it was probably blamed on the Americans as, you know, throwing them overboard.
No, they didn't, actually. This was witnessed by all the Cubans that were returning here.
Oh,
then, you know, they
cannot
blame Americans whatsoever for such a thing. Except that this is something that was done, you know, without pictures, without, you know, and you know how it happened. When Cubans tell these things, everybody called them hysterical, you see. That's one of the things. Nobody believes, you see, these stories, because they seem so unbelievable that who can give credit to things like this? These things like product of imagination, you see. Well,
but,
you know.
But it could be possible.
In there, it is, you see. That's the way things are,
it's,
you know. You never know, because... You know, when I left Cuba so many years back, you know, there were crazy things, you know, actually very cool things done. And it was, you know, 18 years ago when I left the country. Then, you know.
And it's probably worse now.
Oh, sure.
Much worse.
Sure.
Well, I'm about done.
Yeah.